You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein, and I'm in for Leonard Lopate on this cold, gray January afternoon. Woody Allen's new movie, Cassandra's Dream, opens this Friday. It's about two brothers in working-class London who are desperate to better their disappointing lives. Cassandra's Dream is released by the Weinstein Company, and it's my pleasure to welcome Woody Allen to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi.
Hi. I don't want to give away more than you might want to give away, so I would love for you to give us a brief description of what happens in this movie.
Well, I can only tell you that, you know, it's, I mean, what it purports to be, I don't know how successful I am, because I'm not the one that likes to, you know, tout his own movies, but what I tried to do was make a film like Crimes and Misdemeanors or Match Point, where there's a crime and a suspenseful movie that frames a moral dilemma. And hopefully you become interested in these two brothers, and as they get sucked deeper and deeper into a worse and worse situation, and then get involved in a crime, and it leads even to worse tragic results, and hopefully the audience will be caught up in the suspense of the movie and the tension of the film, and that the moral issue raised will not be perceived as homework, but as entertaining.
The suspense begins even before you see anything with the Philip Glass music that you used for this. Did you know when you started that you would want his music to set the mood?
I didn't know before I started. No, I didn't know what kind of music I was going to have in the movie. And then we thought about Philip Glass, and you know, his music is so tense all the time. And when
yes.
he came in and he gave me a tense piece of scoring that he had done the night before, and I said, you know, that's very, very ominous and tense. I don't want it to give away what's going to happen in the scene. And he said, no, what you're listening to now is the love song. You know, I didn't play the tense music for you. That's the love theme when he meets the girl. So you can imagine how, you know, I mean, my hair whitened when I heard his music. It was so chilling.
And this is for the cheery part, although meeting the girl may not be exactly cheery, but this is for the romantic part.
Yes.
What was it like then to work with him if that was his feeling of romance?
What was it like to work with Philip Glass?
Yeah, to work with Philip Glass and to really have it work so that you got the feeling that you wanted for the movie.
It was very pleasurable to work with him because he's a genius. And he's not a pretentious genius, you know. If I would say this music isn't right for this spot, there was never any kind of defensiveness or argument. He'd say, "Fine, no problem. I'll be in tomorrow morning with another piece." And overnight, and I'm talking about overnight, actually, he would write another piece of music, and it would be ready the next morning. And it was just a pleasure. He did the score rapidly and effectively, and you know, the guy's great.
It was in watching this movie, the music plays such a strong role, and it was so different than the music for another one of your recent movies, for Match Point, where it was opera that really moved everything along.
Right. Well, because opera figured actually in the story
almost as a character. Yeah,
so it was easy to do that and had an operatic feel. But I wanted this movie to be in the genre of Match Point or Crimes and Misdemeanors, and give the audience the same kind of pleasure, you know, if I was successful with it.
You have worked a lot in both suspense and comedy, and in watching this movie, which I found very suspenseful, I saw, especially there's one scene, I don't want to give away too much, but there's one scene where the two brothers have broken into the house of a man,
right. Mm-hmm.
And they're waiting for him to return, and he returns, and it was very tense and very suspenseful, and I thought, played just slightly differently, it could have been hilarious. It could have been like a restoration comedy with doors closing. And I wanted to ask you about that, about the use of timing in something that is supposed to be suspenseful. How does timing change from suspense to comedy for you?
Well, you know, even though the film is basically a tragic film and a serious film, you do want there to be some laughs in the film. I mean, so it's not relentlessly like that. And very frequently, the same scene that can be played for drama and great tension can be played for comedy. And you see that all the time. In any of those scenes that you see Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton or Bob Hope play in the movies, those scenes are played for comedy, but they're, you know, the person will be tied up and someone's going to kill them in 15 minutes and they've got to think of a way to escape or some dreadful thing is going to happen. And if you're playing that seriously, you know, you go for one effect, and if you're playing it for comedy, you go for the other effect, but the material can be basically the same.
Mm-hmm. And then what is it that shifts it? Is it, I mean, in this scene, partly it was the music. The brothers, it was a little bit funny, too, because the brothers are a bit bumbling, so.
Yes, it's a sensibility of the writer, of the director and the writer of the film. In my case, you know, I wanted the brothers to be completely, you know, at sea in what they were doing. I wanted them to be not glib and good at it. I wanted them to postpone it, to try and rationalize it, to try and not do it if they didn't have to try and, in the same sense that when you saw a Match Point and Jonathan Rhys Meyers is going to start his murder by killing the next door neighbor first, he goes into the other room, and while the neighbor is taking some medicine in another room, Jonathan Rhys Meyers is trying to put the rifle together.
Right,
and
right.
Having a great deal of trouble, and it's dropping on the floor, and he can't get the parts together. Now, you know, that can be played very funny, and I want it to be amusing. And the same here. The, you know, when the brothers are trying to execute their plan, I want it to be that, you know, some of it's funny because they're inept, and some of it's, but always with it in mind that the conclusion of it is tense.
Yes, and that was successful, at least in my case. I found it very tense. The brothers are likable people at the beginning, and part of the drama of this is seeing them wrestle with a very, very bad decision. Do you think they get caught up in forces that are beyond their own?
Yes, they do. I think the brothers are nice. One is a garage mechanic who's got a nice girlfriend, and he's a decent guy. He does play cards and gamble a bit over his head, but fundamentally he's a decent guy who wants only to, you know, maybe marry the girl and have a family, and the other kid.
He has a few vices, though. He is a little bit fond of drink and gambling, which is a bit of a problem for him.
That is a problem for him, yes,
yeah.
But he's not a bad guy.
No, but he's not a bad guy.
They're just, you know, vices that he has. They don't hurt anybody, but those are vices that he has. Whereas Ewan is very loving to his father and works in his father's restaurant, even though he wants very much to have a life of his own. But his father had had a heart attack, and so before the picture begins, and so you know, he's helping out in the restaurant and putting his own plans on hold because he wants to be decent to his family and to his father, and he has some ambitions of his own. And and these guys are very decent guys, and they get sucked into a bad decision. And once they make that decision and cross that line, things get worse and worse and worse.
I'm speaking, if you haven't already recognized his voice, with Woody Allen, whose new film, Cassandra's Dream, comes out on Friday. In this film, the pull of family is very strong, and many of the characters talk about family, and I felt that there was a almost a mythic quality to this pull of family. And also, you name this Cassandra's Dreams. Cassandra was the figure in Greek mythology who Apollo loved, and she spurned him, and he gave her the gift or the curse of being able to see the future, but no one would believe her.
Right. And that's what I wanted to suggest here, the suggestion of the future and the future being, you know, when you see the guys out at the beginning, they're out on their sailboat and they're having a wonderful time and they bought this boat and they're drinking beer and it's sunny out and they're out with their girlfriends and everything, they're singing and it's wonderful, and yet there is the foreboding sense that the future is not going to be so bright for them, and that things are going to take a dark turn. And Cassandra was someone who was always prophesying the you know, doom of some sort, or bad news of some sort.
And everybody was saying, "Oh, just, you know, Cassandra, just shut up. That we don't believe that's going to happen."
Right, you're such a Cassandra.
Yes, exactly.
But that is what I wanted. And I did want the film to have, you know, a mythic feeling. I wanted it to have a feeling of blood and family and tragedy. And I did feel that it did have that. Now, again, you know, I'm a guy talking about his own film, so of course I, you know, put a rosy thing. It remains for, you know, critics and audiences to see the film and see if they like it. I don't want to be, you know, caught touting my own stuff.
Well, what I'm interested in is the things that sparked for you. Did you find yourself going back to the Greeks and reading them as you were putting this together, or was it more just that feeling that you remembered from these tragedies?
Yes, I don't have to really go back to them. I've read a lot of the Greeks. I've read all the Greek plays and the Greek philosophers and some of the poetry and I have a pretty good knowledge of the Greeks just off the top of my head. And I was able to try and infuse it to the best of my limited ability with that kind of Greek mythological quality to it.
That struggle of brothers, you know, I went back to see, are there brothers who wrestle with this kind of problem in Greek myth? I kept wondering, is this a sort of Cain and Abel thing? But it wasn't exactly that. So you've taken it to another point, I think.
Yeah, it's
as
just
well.
It's just in the style of that, I mean, in the sensibility of that. But it's not based on an actual plot or anything.
Do you find I felt resonances of the Greeks, and in fact, Chris in Matchpoint quotes Sophocles at one point. Do you find that the Greeks you're going back to them more at this point in your life, or have they always been an influence for you?
They've always been something I've been interested in. You know, I always felt there was a moral dilemma in Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Yes.
There was a major moral issue in Matchpoint. And that here there was a moral issue. And even, I was even titillated by the Greeks in an amusing way in Mighty Aphrodite.
Yes,
with the title
there. A very
broad comedy of mine. Because the Greek theater has always interested me.
I know. My mom was an English professor, and she often talked about suspense in the Greeks. And she once said to a class, well, in Oedipus, the reason that it's so powerful is that we, the audience, have knowledge that Oedipus doesn't have. We know that he's a father killer, and the class filled in the rest of it because I couldn't say it on the radio. But is that also something, as we're watching a suspenseful film, or you're creating one, that the audience is a part in this, and we know more than the characters we're watching?
Yes, in this type of film, that's always pleasurable. And other types of murder films and things, crime films, sometimes it's best that the audience doesn't know any more than the lead characters know. So it really depends. But this type of film, you know, the audience does know more than the characters know, really. They know it more just from sensing it at times.
Yes, that it's almost subliminal. It may not be information you've actually been given,
right,
but somehow you know something is going to happen.
Right.
We're going to have to take a quick break. I'm speaking with Woody Allen, and I'll be right back. ¶¶ I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate, and I am speaking by phone with Woody Allen, whose new movie, Cassandra's Dream, comes out on Friday. Now, we've been talking a lot about the Greeks, and one of the things that felt so strongly for me in this movie, as well as in Matchpoint, is this incredible lust for something beyond what you have, which almost felt like the Greek hubris, you know, reaching beyond what you might be able to do. In both this movie and Matchpoint, there are characters who want a girl who's beyond their station, who is looking for a beautiful car that they may not be able to afford.
That is one of the, you know, the common staples of dramatic situations where the person, you know, is motivated by some kind of ambition, whether it's professional or material possessions or romantic, and it's a very, very common motivation in getting characters to do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do, or things that are not quite kosher.
Because that desire pushes them outside of their normal life.
Yes, it's a question of how far they're willing to go to satisfy these things, and that is the moral dilemma of a movie like this.
It also felt, in both these movies, that it was an exploration of class as well, and it made me curious about whether you wrote this for England, where class means one thing, or whether this was you had imagined these as American movies that then got transplanted to a different city.
Well, Matchpoint was, I wrote it as an American movie, and I transplanted it. It was a very easy change because, you know, London is really just like New York. It's a big cosmopolitan center with theaters and restaurants and museums and traffic and energy. And so, you know, the transposition was took me no time to do.
And more people probably have shotguns in their country homes in England, I would assume, than in this country, although maybe not.
Well, yes, they do have shotguns. They don't have handguns.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get a handgun in London. If you were going to shoot somebody, you would not be able to do it except with a shotgun. I mean, unless you knew gangsters that could get you an illegal firearm, but there's no way you can own a firearm, a handgun there. So you would have to do it with a rifle. Now, in Match Point, you know, the guy, the kind of guy that could stab somebody to death, that would require more, you know, I don't know, more bloodlust than he would have, and he wouldn't be able to strangle someone. He really needed a gun, and shotguns are accessible because people on those country estates are always shooting, and very frequently have shotguns. In Cassandra's Dream, I didn't write it for New York. I wrote it for London.
So you knew it was going to be set there when you put it together.
Yes, I knew it was going to be there, so I was able to cover all eventualities.
There, did you find that writing and knowing that these characters were going to be in London, did the dialogue change, or did you find yourself listening to the people that you know in London, or the people that you might want to use as sources in London to think about how these people would talk?
Yeah, you know, you can pretty much, I mean, if you have any common sense, you can pretty much imitate a Londoner. You know, you can imitate their speech, and you pick up their patterns very, very quickly, because, I mean, they're speaking English, so it's you know, fairly simple thing to do. And in the cases where I'd make a mistake, there were many people along the way to correct me when I would, you know, have the script typed up there and all that. Occasionally people would say, oh, we would never say this here, we would call it this, or they'd never go to this restaurant, they would go to that restaurant. And they give me those suggestions right there, and I incorporate them. And then, of course, when the English actors do them, the thing magically becomes British. I mean, when you hear Colin and Ewan doing the dialogue, it's immediately British.
In terms of the words that they say, though, and this may be stereotyping, but do Londoners speak more obliquely? I mean, the stereotype is that Americans are more direct and British are a little bit more indirect.
It's a subtlety that I wouldn't be good enough to pick up on. I mean, I just wrote it as best I could imitate a Londoner in my mind's ear, and I got it right most of the time, and when I didn't, you know, there were minions and myrmidons who came right in and helped me.
Do you find that writing for a particular city, you know, you took one idea and transplanted it to London. Was it lovely to know this is where I'm going to do this so that you could bring London in as a character from the beginning?
It is, yes, it does help. I mean, I'd rather do that than write a script and then go and transpose it. That's, you know, it's double work, and sometimes you have to force things a little bit to retain your original idea. But if you know you're writing for the place, of course, it's much more pleasant.
I am always interested in people's creative process, and I think about something that Mozart once said, which is, I have this string quartet rolling around in my head, and I wish someone would commission me so I could write it down. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, what's your process of writing? Do you get an idea and then write the script, or do you wait until you've got a moment to be able to do it?
Well, no, when I have an idea, I have to sit and think about it for a while. And, you know, with a script, I'm sure my good friend Mozart had the same problem with the symphony. You got to know where it's going. There's got to be a third act, so you don't want to just start off and then you're finished with 40 pages and you're dead in the water and it doesn't go anyplace. So you've got to think about it and develop it and see where it's going and see that the things that that happen in the third act have been carefully laid out to begin with and well orchestrated. And as I say, I'm sure Mozart had the same problem, how to introduce themes that later he could develop the way he wanted and give the audience a big thrill at the end. And that's what you try and do with the script. Is orchestrated in the same way.
Do you find that you do most of that work in your own head, or do you write it down and talk to people about these things as you're kind of envisioning the whole scope of a film?
I keep most of it in my head, and I make very few. I write down very little. I mean, generally for me, I don't ever use more than one page to write down anything that I write down about a script. You know, I write down one line at a time. He meets the girl. He goes to London. His father reprimands him. He, you know, gets thrown out of college. I mean, I go, you know, with some semblance of the chronological order of the picture, but the whole outline is no more detailed than these one-line, step-by-step things.
And then you take that, once you have the sort of vision of the whole thing, and you take that and start writing it?
I don't look at that page anymore. I don't really have to, mm-hmm. because I write it down just in case, you know, I'm struck by amnesia or something and I've got to recall it later, but I don't really have to rely on the page. I mean, I have it in my head, and it's I start writing it from the first dialogue and go, you know, in order through the script, and I there are other writers who write or have written quite differently. I remember talking to Paddy Chayefsky years ago, and he would have an idea and work the idea out, and he might start on page 90 and write a couple of good scenes, and then go to page 40 and write a few good scenes, and then start off and get into that. I can't do that. I didn't learn to do it that way, and it's a habit I developed. I can't go on to the next page until I finish the prior page. But not everybody writes that way.
That's interesting, though, that you need to develop the whole scope of it, and then you need to start at page one and end at the end.
Yeah, once I know the story that, you know, the two brothers and they get themselves in trouble, and that then they come upon a situation that's a moral choice for them, and they make the wrong one, and they get, you know, once I know that, then I start off, you know, right from the beginning. Where would be, what's the first thing I want to show, and what would best serve it. And it's really common sense.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that there's a spark for ideas for you, or do you sort of have a kind of mental file of one day I'd like to get to the idea of the two brothers and this moral dilemma?
Yes, exactly that. I have ideas occurred to me all the time, and I write them down. I mean, it could be on a matchbook or a piece of napkin or something, and I throw them in the drawer, and I take out this disparate-looking, odd collection of scraps, and many of them, I can't imagine what I was thinking when I wrote it down. I don't know what inspired me to write it down. I don't know what the couple of words mean now, even. Or if I do know what they mean, I think, how could I have ever thought that would make a good movie? But there are some of the things that hold up, and I think, yes, this one does look like it's more than just a flashy little good-sounding thing. It looks like it could be developed, it could grow, and there's room for a story to flower. And that's the stuff that I usually work on.
I'm speaking with Woody Allen, whose new film, Cassandra's Dream, opens citywide this Friday. We're talking a little bit about the creative process. And I'm curious about, do you build time into your schedule so that you can write? Because you're so prolific. You have had so many films. Sometimes I see the output and I think, how do you even have time to begin something and now hearing how you do it, to follow it through?
It isn't as time-consuming as you think. You know, if you like to write, I mean, if it's a chore for you, then it's a nuisance. But if it's not a chore, I write just about every day because I like to write.
And
so,
it's a pleasure for you, it
you know,
like,
yeah. So yeah. I get up on a Saturday or Sunday, I write because it's fun, in the same way that I practice my clarinet because, you know, I enjoy doing it. If I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't do it because I'm lazy and not nearly so disciplined as people think. I'm not disciplined enough to do it if I didn't like it and force myself. But I enjoy it. So if you get up in the morning and you write, you know, you get stuff accomplished. You know, just write a couple of pages or half a page or 5 pages or whatever your output is for the time you write that day. And then you throw it in the drawer and add to it, and gradually you get a script, and then you make it. I mean, this is not, you know, it's not the same thing as people that write a script. I don't have the same situation. I'm usually don't work until the film is financed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but many people. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, many
yes.
people will write a film and then they've got to spend, you know, a year figuring out how to get it financed, and they go to lunch with movie stars, and they go to lunch with producers, and this guy's interested, and then they lose interest, and they get somebody else, and they're interested if you can get somebody else interested, and this goes on.
It becomes a full-time job. Yeah.
Series of lunch meetings and phone calls, and finally they either do or don't get it on. I don't have that problem. I pull it out of the typewriter on Monday and bring it over to my producer, my office, production office, and it goes to works. And you know, 4 weeks later, it's budgeted, and we're hiring people, and I make it. I can't have elaborate shooting schedules that take forever because we don't have the money. And I shoot the film pretty fast. And you know, now you edit electronically, so you edit very quickly, and the whole thing doesn't take a year. It takes almost a year, but it doesn't take a year. And then I'm finished, and I sit around for a day or two twiddling my thumbs, wondering why I'm not having any fun or what I should be doing or why the idea of going to St. Bart's or something and laying on the beach is totally unappealing to me.
It's a hard thing for me to picture that would be something. It sounds like doing things is much more fun for you.
Yeah, so I start writing again, you know, but not out of any compulsive workaholic anxiety. It's just that, you know, I get bored looking out the window or walking around Central Park more than a day or so. And I want to get up in the morning and get back to the typewriter.
You talked about your production schedule on your movies, and I read that in London, one of the things you wished you could have had was more days of rain, but they said, no, you can't have more rain. In both Match Point and in this movie, rain is almost its own character in the film.
I like gray, drizzly days. I like them all the time. I mean, I like them for my mood. I like them because they're romantic. They make New York look beautiful. They make London look beautiful. One of the problems I had this past summer, I shot a film in Barcelona, a romantic movie in Barcelona, with Javier Bardem, Penelope Cruz, and Scarlett Johansson. And Barcelona's sunny. And so, you know, that was the hardest part of it. I mean, they have wonderful crews, wonderful people. You know, everything was great. The one part that was difficult was that we were constantly, constantly blocking out the sun, because I don't like the sun in my movies.
Mm. And so you were turning, in a sense, Barcelona into New York or London a little bit.
Well, I was trying to make it look good. You know, it's hard to photograph a place.
In bright light.
You know, in bright light. So, you know, if you shine a hot light on a beautiful woman, it's not as flattering, no matter how beautiful she is, as if you shine, say, a slightly red-tinted light on her or something, a soft tinted light or an amber light, and it's just more flattering. And the same thing is true of a city. If the city if it's gray and kind of got a soft light to it, it looks very beautiful. But if the sun is beating down, you know, it's hard. Now, certain times of the day, it becomes easier. If the sun drops and you have low light and it's behind what you're shooting, then it works.
Mm-hmm.
But that only gives you a very limited shooting time because the sun moves so fast. You know, you don't realize it till you shoot a movie, but, you know, you set up for 20 minutes and the sun has moved. You got to pull up your setup and set up again, and, you know, it drives you crazy.
I hadn't thought about that you have to follow the sun.
Or run from it.
Well, the gray skies of London are a part of this new movie, Cassandra's Dream, which opens this Friday. Woody Allen, thank you so much for joining me here on the Leonard Lopate Show today.
Well, thanks. It's been great fun, and thanks very much.
A pleasure.
Okay.